Welcome to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by the law firm of Deason, Garner, and Hanson, hosted by attorneys Sean Garner and Adam Hanson.
Welcome back to Life, Death, and the Law. I'm in the studio today with Sean Garner and Cody Beeson. And Sean has a clip that he wants to play for us to get the show started here from Tucker Carlson, and he wants to get our take on it, and he thinks it's a pretty interesting video. So why don't you go ahead and cue that up, Sean? What's going on here?
Here we go. Tucker, you're up. Tucker's on Joe Rogan's show, and they're discussing war in general. So let's hear what Tucker's opinion is on the nuclear, or the decision to drop the nuclear bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And I was a bit surprised by this. This isn't a topic that randomly would come up for a radio show today, but this brought it to the forefront, this clip right here.
Same about the atomic bomb, right?
Yes, you could.
And you could say that we have to develop it like Oppenheimer felt before the Nazis did.
I love that. How'd that work? How'd that work?
Well,
I love, by the way, that people on my side, I'll just admit it, on the right, you know, have spent the last 80 years defending dropping nuclear weapons on civilians. Like, are you joking?
Right.
That's just like prima facie evil.
Yeah.
If you can't, well, if we hadn't done that, then this, that, the other thing, that was actually a great savings life. No, it's wrong to drop nuclear weapons on people. And if you find yourself arguing that it's a good thing to drop nuclear weapons on people, then you are evil. Like, it's not a tough one, right? It's
right.
Not a hard call for you. It's not a hard call for me. So with that in mind, like, why would you want nuclear weapons? It's like just a mindless, childish sort of intellectual exercise to justify, like, oh no, it's really good because someone else will get it. How about no? How about like spending all of your effort to prevent this from happening? Would you kill baby Hitler, you know, famously?
Right.
So I don't know why we're sitting back and allowing this to happen if we really believe it will extinguish the human race or enslave the human race. Like, how can that be good?
What's your initial reaction to that, Adam?
I think
it surprised you.
Did it surprise me
that Tucker would take such an absolute position that there's no arguing point? It's prima facie
evil. Person,
evil.
Yeah.
Prima facie is a legal term. It means that it's
on its face.
Yeah, there's no question about it. It's black and white.
So I find myself in the camp of, and I haven't done a lot of soul searching about Hiroshima and dropping a nuke on it. My general understanding of what I understood to be the case was the relentlessness of the Japanese was never going to stop, save we stop it with such force of a nuclear weapon to deter them from moving forward with any further fighting, because they were just relentless. You think of that kamikaze type act. They're willing to put it all on the line to death, right? That's what I've been told or taught, I guess, over the years. So my understanding of dropping the nuclear weapon was do as little damage as possible to the population. We could do more if we wanted, but it was more of so a show of force. It ended the war definitively, so it achieved its purpose. So I think it's, from where we are, to answer your question, Sean, in my opinion, not that it's relevant or right or anything like that, but I believe it was a right call because it ended the war abruptly, and it achieved its purpose. Did innocent people die? Yes, absolutely. Innocent people have died throughout World War II on both sides due to the atrocities of both sides fighting in Germany, in Japan, all over the world, in the European forum. So war is war. It doesn't respect innocent versus bad guy. And when you're caught up in that, unfortunately, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. I take issue with Tucker saying, because I have that opinion, I'm an evil person.
Yeah.
I'm a God-fearing person, and I believe in Jesus Christ. Having said that, I also believe that God has a plan, and we as his children are here on earth to help others, you know, come to God. And part of that is through hardship, such as war or trials in our personal lives. That's my personal belief. So I
I share that belief with you. You know, we're on similar wavelengths there.
Well, with a myopic view of if this mortality was it, then I might agree with Tucker in the sense of mass innocent casualties would be horrendous. But when you have a what do you call it, an eternal view or something like that,
yeah,
like there is life after this, then in the big picture of things, it's horrible. It's still horrible.
Okay,
but
and that's where I split with you.
Okay,
and the reason why is because I think even if you are only looking at this lifetime, and looking at statistically what had happened in the war. And of course, I'm not a war historian. I'm not a statistician, but the Japanese had killed millions, millions upon millions. In fact, a lot of the things that the Japanese did are overshadowed by the Holocaust. And I don't know why, perhaps the same reason why a lot of the genocides that are occurring in Africa are overshadowed by the so-called genocide that is occurring in the Middle East or the Ukraine-Russia war. And it's because they're white or they're people that we can familiarize more with. And we don't see that the same way in Japan and the Pacific. And what do you call people?
Culture. It's a different culture. I don't know, though, because I take issue with... It's not because they're white. I could care less what race they are.
But why do we put so much emphasis then on that?
Because that's, in my opinion, again, I don't know. It's what the media portrays as being, or politicians or lobbyists are portraying as the great war or the evil of our time. And we're relying on them to give us, you need to care about this issue in Palestine and Israel, even though it's been going on for hundreds of years. Now is a time that you need to get involved and take sides because it's going to be advantageous to somebody somewhere monetarily is what my guess is. That's what I don't think it's a race thing. I mean, we have nothing in common. Western society has nothing in common with Eastern mindset of those in Palestine. Like we are from a Judeo-Christian background, almost night and day compared to those that are living in Palestine under Muslim rule or following the Quran. So I don't think it has anything to do with race. I think it's all about, I think it's our culture. I think it's whatever the media and politicians want to portray to us as American ignorant class, whatever we just eat up whatever they give us as being important. In reality, it's happening everywhere.
Yeah,
in China, it's happening in Africa.
Well, because think about it, we don't hear how many people do you think the Japanese killed leading up to our entrance in World War II, going through China and doing ethnic cleansing of their own. Just throw out a number.
Do you have it?
I do.
Okay, so you can.
I have a fact check.
Tell me how stupid
it's what
I am.
Wikipedia says, and you can't argue with Wikipedia.
Perfect. That's always right. Okay, the question is, how many of the Japanese kill
through their ethnic cleansing program
prior to us getting involved in world prior to Pearl Harbor is what you're asking?
Correct.
Okay, I'm gonna guess 3 million.
They estimate that it's somewhere between 30 and 100 million.
Wow.
And that's just what they're telling you.
And when you have to make estimates that have a margin of error of 70 million, It's unfathomable. It blows your mind. Now, how many people died during the atomic attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? It's estimated between 150 and 200,000. And there are a lot of different estimates. You know, the initial blast, of course, there were the casualties from that, and then there were casualties from the residual nuclear activity and cancer and those types of illnesses. But we're talking about there was a terrible, terrible regime in power at that time. And they wanted to keep the emperor in power. But the generals were running the army. The emperor wasn't making the day-to-day decisions. The generals, the Japanese generals, were running the army. In fact, several generals rebelled against the emperor's decision to accept unconditional surrender. And others committed, I forget the name of the suicide, but it's when
seppuku.
Seppuku.
Yeah.
Where they take a saber and they thrust it into their abdomen and then bring it up through their internal organs. And they preferred that to a peace agreement with the Americans. So that's the mentality, and they were very effective in implementing that type of mentality, not only in the mainland Japanese civilians, but in the islands around them. For example, the Okinawans, they were not full-blood Japanese. They were not viewed by the Japanese as fully being Japanese, but they were of the Japanese descent. And so they were there, and the Japanese military indoctrinated them that the Americans would do atrocities to them if they were captured, so much so that even after the island was taken, the civilians continued to fight. And when they couldn't fight, many times it was witnessed that women would jump off of cliffs with their children in their hands because they were so terrified of what the Americans would do. So they were willing to fight to the last, and civilians as well as combatants involved. It's estimated that about 90,000 Japanese combatants died fighting in Okinawa, and 150,000 civilians in Okinawa. And now this is your conventional warfare. Those numbers alone, just on their face, in a small island off of Japanese, this is not the mainland, those numbers outweigh the people that were killed in the atomic bombs. So how can I be prima facie evil, thinking it's better to end the war quickly, with even if it's 200,000 dead, and even if they are civilians, with a regime that's in power willing to kill millions upon millions and willing to do it until the very end, and if they can't achieve their means, they'll commit suicide and encourage suicide on the civilians that are under their rule.
Cody, you've been chomping at the bit. What say ye?
Oh, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, how arrogant of us to have the luxury of sitting back and looking at this.
That was my same thought process. I was actually going to say that before you said that. I was like, yeah.
Because, I mean, what would the American forces look like if they had gone toe-to-toe and were decimated? Then what position would we be in to be challenged by another nation? So at the end of the day, I mean, it's war, and I think we just have this luxury of looking at it with this PC lens. All war is a crime. You know, it doesn't matter if... you know, it's the Vietnamese, you know, or whatever Japanese, whatever nation is at war, we're at war with. That's all evil and bad. And it's actually what we were just talking about earlier, kind of going against what Jesus taught.
Well, you know? Okay. So, and that's the Quaker standpoint, right? So that is, you don't kill under any circumstances. My standpoint is you do kill, and it's actually my duty to kill, to defend my country, liberty, my family, my life. If I don't, if I stand by and allow liberty to be overthrown by a dictatorship, and I have the ability to stand up and defend my country and my family, then I am a coward and I am a sinner for having let that occur. And so I don't think that's evil for me to participate in war from a defensive position.
Oh, yeah, I don't think I was going there.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify.
Oh, yeah, no, but I'm saying we should feed and love one another. I mean, we should work on that, but...
Absolutely.
You know.
But the question was, and Tucker, man, he has some great points, and he has a way of putting together a lot of facts in a way that are very compelling, but when he said this and then just labeled everybody... He did exactly what I feel like is getting done from the lefty wokes, that if you don't agree with my position, you're evil. It's not that you have to just tolerate it. It's not that you just have to accept and coexist with it. You must embrace that position or you're evil. And that's where Tucker fell off the cliff with me. It was like, listen, there are differences of opinion as to whether or not the atomic bomb was good in ending the war. I'm one of those that espouses those positions. I've studied it to the extent that I was a undergrad in national security defense. I studied quite a bit of that as a political science major. And my professor served in the Reagan administration as a national security advisor. And he talked about the atomic bomb extensively and how much of a saving grace and how happy everybody was that the war was ending on both sides. I mean, the Japanese as well, they were happy to end the war. We don't want, the civilians didn't want to carry out the instructions that they were given to sharpen bamboo sticks, to take kitchen knives and defend the home island to the very last person. They wanted peace. Most civilians do. It's a very few that want war and are so hungry for power that catapult the rest of the nation into war. The rest of us want peace. And for that surrender to come, I think, and now this is me taking a leap, I think that was a great relief to many Japanese civilians.
We've got to go to break. The question becomes, I mean, is this necessary again? I think, I believe that a nuke will be used again at some point, whether it's us or somebody, one of our enemies. I'm guessing one of our enemies. But is it necessary? We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Life, Death, and the Law. Don't miss out. Deason Garner and Hansen is hosting an estate planning seminar June 21st at the Foothills Library at 2:30 p.m. Call 928-783-4575 or visit yuma.law today. Don't miss out. Deason Garner and Hansen is hosting an estate planning seminar June 21st at the Foothills Library at 2:30 p.m. Call 928-783-4575 or visit yuma.law today. Welcome back to Life, Death, and Law. I'm attorney Adam Hansen. I've got my partner in crime here, Sean Garner. We've got Cody Beeson as well with us today. And in the last segment, we played a clip from Tucker Carlson speaking with Joe Rogan about the use of a nuclear weapon during the World War II combat in order to end that war. And Tucker made some very,
incendiary, I would call it, but
yeah, and you took issue with this, Sean, and rightfully so. You know, what Tucker said was, if you agree with what we did as Americans and dropping the nuclear weapons on those two islands, then or in those two
cities,
then you are basically an evil person, and that's what he said. You're an evil person. Tucker Carlson said that. Tucker, he says those things. Like, I've watched so many interviews with Tucker, and he'll say things like that, you're this, or he'll create labels and stuff. And I don't always agree with that. I'm like, yeah, Tucker, you're going a little far right there. Whether he believes it or not, I don't know. You know, like, if you were to debate on that, I don't know. He said it. It's not going to make me stop listening to Tucker. I think I agree with Tucker probably 95% of the time. Sometimes he'll say something like that. It's a little incendiary or outlandish. And I'm like, you know, I say that to you. You'll say things to me all the time, and I say things to you. Most of the time, it's me saying them to you, and you're like, yeah, that's out
right
there.
Like, if it was Pete Buttigieg saying that, or if it was even Joe Biden, or if it was Gavin Newsom saying that, then I wouldn't even play the clip, because I think that they live in a la-la land that's not in touch with reality. But I think Tucker Carlson has a broader view. I tend to agree with his points. I think he called into question whether or not we ought to get involved in the war in Ukraine, and whether or not we should send support via monetary and weapon support to Ukraine. And I thought that was good to question that. Now, he's come very strong against it, and I'm still not 100% settled on the issue. I'm leaning against it because he makes persuasive arguments. But boy, he lost some big points for me on that one when he just said everybody that believes that dropping the atomic bomb on those two cities was evil, and you can never make, even attempt to make, an argument for the benefit that occurred as a result, meaning ending the war and the combat that had occurred and all the civilian lives that would have been saved, not to mention the combatants that would have been saved. I mean, I watched in preparing for this show, after I heard that clip, a lot of clips from individuals who lived during that time period and who were actually assigned for the assault on the mainland. In fact, there was two different plans to assault the mainland. One was with 1 million soldiers and another with 2 million soldiers. And almost every one of them said they wept when they heard that the Japanese surrendered. They wept because they felt that they would now be able to have children and grow old and live out their lives, because they felt that they were going to go into that what they had been experiencing, and it's a kamikaze style of war, which it's going to fight to the bitter end, not to a surrender, not to one person shows overwhelming strength, but death, complete death on one side or the other.
I think when viewed, so where I take issue with Tucker is that he's trying to frame this from an ethical standpoint, and war is not ethical. It's not. I mean, there are no rules in war. We like to believe that there are, but in reality, there are no rules. Once you get to the point of war, it is you are going until the other person submits or gives up, and that's what needed to happen in World War II. It required, well, did it require a nuke? Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but it actually worked. I mean, it solved the issue.
I agree that there could have been a victory without it. I just don't agree with people Monday morning quarterbacking and saying we're evil for having done it, especially with the glaring, not only possibility, but likelihood that hundreds of thousands, if not millions, would have died in that final struggle.
Absolutely. So when you come from an ethical standpoint, of course it's not going to be ethical. You're killing thousands, millions of people, you know, in one fell swoop, and that's unethical from your normal daily living. But when you're in wartime, there is no ethics. You know, we like to pretend that there are, that there's a Geneva Conventions and things like that. But in reality, you know, you had I think of the Revolutionary War, where you had the British that would form their formations, and then they have this very regulated, gentlemanly way of doing things. And the Americans were coming off of the French Indian War, and they were like guerrillas.
Guerrilla warfare.
That gets me excited. It's like, why am I going to line up with all these people and just take it, you know, take a musket ball to the face or to the head? And then like, oh, okay, hopefully I don't get hit here. It's like, no way, man, I'm going to hide behind trees with tomahawks and do everything I can to wreak havoc on my opponent or my enemy. So all those rules were out the window. Do we have rules set up through the Geneva Convention? Yes. Are they adhered to? Maybe 80%, maybe. You know, I think those that are viewed as our allies, probably we adhere to them more than others, but I think there's a lot going on behind the scenes that we don't even know about through CIA, FBI, all sorts of hits. I mean, the Saudi Arabian king just recently went down in a helicopter crash, and I was like, the first thing I thought was, that was us.
No, that was the Iranian president.
Yeah, there you go. The Iranian president went down in a helicopter crash just a month ago, you know? And for our media, I mean, it came out in the news story, and I'm thinking to myself, the first thought I had was, we did that. But, you know, I don't know. I really don't know. But it's reported as, you know, a failure because of the equipment in that helicopter and the weather.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, okay, sure. But in reality, I'm sure we're pulling strings and doing things behind the scenes. When I say we, I mean our agencies here. And that goes to our elections. I mean, getting into conspiracy theories and stuff like that, elections. And I heard this doozy the other day, Sean. You're not going to like this. This is a doozy. And it's kind of getting off topic.
Are you an election denier? Because we're about to get canceled if you say that.
Okay. I don't know if this is real or not, but apparently, since Trump was indicted and then he was found, you know,
guilty.
Guilty, and now is
guilty as charged. Felon.
Coming up on his sentencing, I think this week, actually. We'll see what's going on. But when that all happened, the question became, you know, like, is he going to be vindictive about going back at some of these political rivals? And one of the things that came up in my perusing the internet, which is always true, was him declassify. If he wins again, he's going to declassify all these things, one of which was the JFK files. And so I went down that rabbit hole. And have you heard about this? So apparently he was going to do all, he was going to declassify. You're smiling. No, do you know about this?
Yeah.
You know about this? Okay, so before he left office.
Are we going into the Epstein stuff?
That was one of the things too, but we're just talking about JFK, just JFK alone.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I was watching this interview of one of the guys that's really close to Trump, and I'm going to paraphrase this and totally botch this interview, but he was giving this interview and they're asking him about the JFK files. And he's like, yeah, I talked to Trump after he was, after he lost the election, he's about to leave coming up on January 6th. And he gives him a call. He's like, hey, you didn't do what you promised me you would do. And Trump said, like, what was it? Like, I'll do anything. What did I not do? He said, you didn't declassify the JFK files. And my understanding, if I remember or recollect correctly, Trump said something, if I were to do that, it would undo America like you know it today. And so I'm telling my wife this, and she's way in the know of all these conspiracy theories more than I am. She's like, oh, yeah. Apparently, the theory or the conspiracy theory is that ever since that the JFK assassination was carried out somehow with the CIA, through the CIA for some reason. I don't know the reasoning. I don't know. But my wife was telling me all this. Like, she knew it. Like, oh, yeah. Like, that's common knowledge. And then she said something like, the theory is that ever since JFK, it's been a plant in the presidency. The CIA has been basically planting their own presidents. We vote and all this kind of stuff. But really, the CIA is actually behind everything, they're picking the president and who's going to do all that. And then she said, again, you know, this is a conspiracy theory. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but it's fun to think about. And she said, until it got to Trump. So Hillary was supposed to win. And that's why it was so crazy that she didn't, because somehow he broke the system. And that's why he's not liked very much by that side or by the deep state. Whether or not this is true, I don't know. But it's fun to think about. What do you think, Cody?
I mean, I think there's extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, right?
Mm-hmm. And I like that.
And have we not seen a lot of fishy stuff with the government? I mean, what you're seeing, you know, as far as the CIA and the FBI interfering in elections and basically making kings. I mean, didn't we see that with the Democratic convention in 2015 when it was supposed to be Bernie, but Hillary got it? Did we not see that with others that they've put in place to cover their tracks? I mean, didn't we see that with the Twitter files? I mean, in a way, the FBI has become like a Gestapo, you know, doing the orders that, you know, the elite or whoever is running the show dictate. And it sounds crazy, but the proof has been out there. You know, they keep releasing this stuff where they are interfering in our elections.
Back at the early 2000s.
It's interesting that Lee Harvey Oswald also got killed before he could be brought to trial and questioned and examined. That's the one thing that I hang my hat on that says, okay, that stinks a little bit of a conspiracy. But most of the other stuff I steer away from until, like Cody said, you said it very well, it requires extraordinary proof. All this alien stuff that is being talked about, I steer far clear from that because I'm just not a believer in aliens. And unless I see something hovering over my house, like trying to beam up my goats and chickens and whatnot for examination, that's the type of extraordinary proof I'm going to need. I'm not going to need, like, because AI is so powerful out there, and generation of images and video and every other type of proof that you want. I'm not going to go with that. And the same thing with the JFK assassination. I'm going to take it for face value for what it is until that extraordinary evidence comes up. So that's my take on it.
I think, so I was going to say, back in the early 2000s, I lived in Spain for a couple of years, and I met a few Venezuelan families. And I was what, 18, 19 at the time. I was completely naive to world events and things like that. And when I met this family, the kids were fantastic. The families were fantastic. You know, I really had great relationship with the families that I met, and the older generation of that family hated Americans, and I asked them, you know, what's the deal? Like, why don't you like the United States? Everybody loves America. And he goes on to tell me, the grandpa told me, was telling me about how the United States had supplied arms to some sort of guerrillas or something down there, and it was mass like casualties and all sorts of like political coup stuff, which I was completely naive to. I had no idea. But I mean, it's like our agencies are constantly inserting themselves, I feel like, in foreign countries, dictating what's going on in those countries. Why could they not do that here in the United States?
Mm-hmm. 1,000%. Yeah. I mean, why are we the ones that we're not going to mess with? They only mess with foreign elections?
Yeah.
Would you?
And the Edward Snowden thing, you know, when he shows that they're spying on all of us, that they're taking all of our phone calls and emails and our text messages, they're not looking at them, but they're taking them just in case. That to me is like, wow, okay, there's that deep state looking for any type of opposition and setting up a way to take them down. Even more recently with this FinCEN law, and to remind our audience, FinCEN is the requirement now as of 2024, January 2024, you must register if you're a small business with the Financial Crime Enforcement Network. You must register as if you're a criminal with the Financial Crime Enforcement Network. And you have to disclose your Social Security, your home address, everybody that participates in your business on a managerial role. This makes us all feel like criminals, and they're saying, we're just doing it to stop money laundering. Well, you know what? Go after the money launderers and people you have evidence on, but don't create a registry as if I'm a criminal, as if I have to give my fingerprints and my DNA to you up front until you want to bring up a case against me. That makes me feel like they're just setting up the case until I say the wrong thing or take the wrong position on a political issue.
Absolutely. We got to go to break. This is Life, Death, and the Law. We'll be back after this. Don't miss out. Deason Garner and Hanson is hosting an estate planning seminar June 21st at the Foothills Library at 2:30 p.m. Call 928-783-4575 or visit yuma.law today. Don't miss out. Deason Garner and Hanson is hosting an estate planning seminar June 21st at the Foothills Library at 2:30 p.m. Call 928-783-4575 or visit yuma.law today. Welcome back to Life, Death, and Law. I'm attorney Adam Hanson, and I've got my partner in crime here. We've got Sean Garner. We've got Cody Beeson as well. We've been talking a lot about the past history of dropping a nuke on the Japanese to end World War II. Was it the right thing to do?
And are you unethical and prima facie evil, as Tucker Carlson alleges, if you agreed with that decision?
Sean, you have a little bit of a rebuttal to that in this video.
Yeah,
this,
so of course,
audio tape that you're going to hear.
I'm not a historian, so I look to people that study this for a career and that have a lot more facts at their disposal and have spent a lot more time thinking about it than me. And I went through probably 24 videos, both on the left and the right. And I found this rebuttal to be the most succinct, so I'm going to play it here on air.
President Harry S. Truman's decision to use atomic weapons against the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki proved to be one of the most controversial decisions in American history. As the years have passed, the controversy has only intensified. More and more people, both in America and abroad, have condemned both President Truman and America for that decision. But this criticism is based on limited historical knowledge of both the situation Truman confronted and the basis for his decision. Such flawed analysis has been aided by the unfortunate influence of some very bad history, such as that written by members of the so-called atomic diplomacy school. These historians disgracefully allege that Truman proceeded to drop two atomic bombs on a Japan which he knew was on the verge of surrender so as to intimidate the Soviet Union in the already developing Cold War. That specious interpretation must be refuted fully. Truman sought to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki two major military-industrial targets to avoid an invasion of Japan, which Truman knew would mean, in his words, quote, an Okinawa from one end of Japan to the other, end quote. His assumptions were entirely legitimate. By July of 1945, the Japanese had been subjected to months of devastating attacks by American B-29s. Their capital and other major cities had suffered extensive damage, and the home islands were subjected to a naval blockade that made food and fuel increasingly scarce. Japanese military and civilian losses had reached approximately 3 million, and there seemed no end in sight. Despite all this, however, Japan's leaders, and especially its military, clung fiercely to notions of getsu-go, decisive battle. In fact, the Japanese government had mobilized a large part of the population into a national militia which would be deployed to defend the home islands. Confirming the Japanese determination to fight on is the fact that even after the use of the atomic bombs against both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese military still wanted to pursue that desperate option. The atomic bombs forced Emperor Hirohito to understand clearly, and in a way his military leaders refused to comprehend, that the defense of the homeland was hopeless. It took the unprecedented intervention of a Japanese emperor to break the impasse in the Japanese government and finally order surrender. It was only the dropping of the atom bombs that allowed the emperor and the so-called peace faction in the Japanese government to negotiate an end to the war. All the viable alternate scenarios to secure American victory, all would have meant significantly greater American and Allied casualties and much higher Japanese civilian and military casualties. According to American military estimates at the time, those numbers would have been well above 1 million. Hard as it may be to accept, Japanese losses would have been far greater without the bombs. And the overall casualties would also have included thousands of Allied prisoners of war whom the Japanese planned to execute in case of invasion. Truman's use of the bomb should be seen as his choosing the least awful of the options available to him. Even in retrospect, far removed from the pressures that Truman faced in 1945, his critics can offer no serious and convincing proposal regarding a viable and less costly alternative. The judgment of history is clear and unambiguous. The atomic bombs shortened the war, averted the need for a land invasion, saved countless more lives on both sides of the blood-soaked conflict than they cost, and ended the Japanese brutalization of the conquered peoples of Asia. Given the alternatives, what would any moral person have done in Truman's position? I'm Father Wilson Miscambell, professor of history at Notre Dame, for Prager.
Okay, so he's obviously put his time and effort into studying this decision, and I think that's enough on that issue that at least there's an argument you're not an evil person for agreeing with the decision to end the war promptly. And the final point that I want to put on it is, how can you argue with the outcome? Japan, look at it today, highly successful. The war did end 3 days after the dropping of the second bomb. And I think that, again, is very, very clear proof that bombs were of that extent were necessary, because the first bomb, if they weren't necessary whatsoever, if they were an absolute overkill, then the surrender would have happened after the first bomb. But it didn't. The first bomb occurred on August 6th, 3 days later. After the Japanese still refused to surrender, a second bomb was dropped. Some of the study that I looked into and the strategic targets that they were looking at, Harry Truman actually deferred that decision to the military leaders. So that was the U.S. military leaders, not Truman's decision as to where they would be dropped, but they wanted to drop them on primarily military targets, but also that had been unscathed by the war, to demonstrate, to do the shock and awe necessary to have the emperor make the decision, and that were to avoid where the emperor was. They didn't know where the emperor was, but they thought he might be in areas that were heavily militarized to be protected. They didn't want to kill the emperor because they knew that he was the best chance to order a surrender, and so they didn't have to continue to fight with these military generals that would compel the civilian combatants and themselves to fight until the last. So that is my position on it, and if that makes me an immoral person, Tucker, then so be it.
The thought that comes to mind as we're reviewing all this stuff from the past is, number one, like Cody had brought out before, it's so easy for us to sit here in our plush chairs reaping the benefits of what was done by our predecessors in that war, sacrificing their lives, putting blood forth to allow us to sit here and speak today as if we have some sort of relevance or something to say, number one. Number two, the thought came to mind as we're reviewing all this is the idea of presidential immunity. So my wife and I, just last week, she brought up this presidential immunity that we're seeing thrown around because of the Trump indictments on the federal level by Jack Smith. That was one of the arguments that the Trump team brought forth, is he's immune because at the time that January 6th happened, he was still the acting president of the United States. His speech given that day was an act, was a presidential act, and therefore, because it was in the act of his presidency, he's immune from the consequences of what happened from that particular speech. Be it what you think, whether he incited a riot or not on the Capitol, that's not at issue here. But what they're bringing up is this idea of presidential immunity. And my wife and I had this conversation just last week. She brought it up. She said, "You know, I don't know what I think about that, because like, what are they immune for anything? Is a president immune for anything?" I bring this up because I think of Harry Truman and that nuke that he decided to drop. Is he immune from the consequences of the American people or even the Japanese people when you bring in the, if you want to,
people still think he should be, you know, retroactively convicted of war crimes.
There you go. Not only that, but maybe his heirs, if he had any heirs, and it goes on and on and on. This and that kind of sentiment brings me to like the, what do you call those? Oh my gosh, cut that out. The, for slaves,
reparations.
Reparations, yeah. Reparations. It's like, to me, that's kind of the same thing. I'm going to go after Harry Truman's family because of a presidential act that he made, or a choice that he made in the act of war as a president of the United States. The idea is that he has immunity so that he could make these really, really hard decisions. Yes, it might be unethical from the lens of ethics, but in wartime, like I mentioned, ethics goes out the door. You got to do what you got to do to win that
war. It could even be wrong in the 2020 vision of hindsight, but you don't have that luxury in the heat of the war.
Do we want our presidents to be chilled when making decisions
and second guessing themselves
in that
all
type
the time
of situation? And so I agree with the doctrine of presidential immunity, but I think what my wife was getting to is, well, does that extend to other things for that president? So long as he's president at the time, he can do anything he wants. My understanding of president, and I'm not a scholar when it comes to this, or we don't practice in this area, Sean, of the law, but I mean, our basic understanding is that while acting as a president under and doing presidential acts, what's my explanation to my wife is that he is immune from liability. But if he were to, even as an acting president, leave the White House one night, he doesn't like somebody, so he drives to their house and shoots that person and murders them, he's not immune just because he's a president for doing that. That's a private act that he committed outside the purview of his presidency. But while he's acting, or she, whoever the president is, under the purview of a presidential act, they have complete immunity. That's how it is now. We're going to see if that's going to hold up in the Supreme Court, whether they decide that is true or not. We're going to get the doctrine coming out, which is another good thing. I mean, as much as Trump is being put to the fire here. Like I told my wife, I'm optimistic in the sense of it sucks that he has to go through all this. It really does. But what's happening here is our Constitution is being tested. And like I said, it's no fun for him to have to go through this, but I'm actually kind of thankful that he is, because this is a test in our Constitution and the executive power and the separation of power doctrine. We're going to see the Supreme Court now coming out with a lot of clarification and definitive laws when it comes to separation of powers in the next coming months because of the Trump persecution. So it's bad on its face. I don't like to see it happen. It's horrible, actually. You know, it's completely partisan what's happening, but at the same time, it is going to allow us to parse out questions of first impression at the Supreme Court level that really are going to either bolster up our Constitution or make it hang by a thread or destroy it. My guess is that my optimism is such that when these cases go through the Supreme Court, they're going to hearken back to the founders' intent when creating the Constitution and the actual written words and those things that were said in the Constitutional Convention, and bolster up the eternal principles that were put forth or enumerated in our Constitution. I don't foresee this court actually upending that. So I'm actually kind of excited to see what's going to come down the pipe. Sean, what do you think about that? Do you think our Constitution is going to be torn apart?
I think it's there. I think it's very close. Quite honestly, I think that if you look at 90% of the laws that are in place and on the books right now, they're unconstitutional. I think the Constitution is essentially a shadow of what it was intended to be. And a lot of these things there needs to be a huge referendum. You said early on in a different show that stare decisis, the idea that the court really needs to give a lot of deference to prior decisions, that policy needs to be revoked. I think we need to give a fresh look at whether every decision fits within the four corners of the actual Constitution, not how it's been interpreted and spun backwards and upside down. That's all the time that we have for this show. We'll talk to you next week. This is Life, Death, and the Law.
Don't miss out. Deason Garner and Hanson is hosting an estate planning seminar June 21st at the Foothills Library at 2:30 p.m. Call 928-783-4575 or visit yuma.law today.